Chairs No Waiting, episode number 461, Margaret Carey Interview Part 1. Two Chairs No Waiting is brought to you by the folks over at WeaversDepartmentStore.com. Drop by over at Weavers. The year has just started, but you need to head over there and you got something brand new. You can pick up some Barney Mayberry dog tags. That's right, so you can be identified when you're weighing in. Go check that out. But the year's just started, as I was saying. Get your Mayberry calendar for 2018. The month's half over already. You got to go get one over at WeaversDepartmentStore.com. Two Chairs No Waiting is also brought to you by donations from listeners like you. The executive producer of episode 461 is Paul Mulick. So thank you, Paul, for your support for the show. And thank you for being here as well. It's always, what would I be doing the show other than talking to myself if it weren't for you? And who am I? I'm Alan Newsome, your host for Two Chairs No Waiting. It's always great to spend time in Mayberry with you. Now, I had the great opportunity back in October of 2017 to go on the Mayberry Cruise. Now, that was our 12th annual Mayberry Cruise. And this year's special guest was Margaret Carey. Now, she played Bess Muggins and Helen Scobie on the Andy Griffith Show. Basically the same character, but with two different names. Could have been a witness protection program, I suppose. Anyway, Margaret is an amazing lady who I've gotten to know over the years doing Mayberry events. And got to spend a lot more time with her on the cruise. And it was great. Her and her son, Eric, both great people to be around. I very much enjoyed it. Got to sit with them at the dinner table and talk. And wow, what a great time I had. And she's had an amazing career. And we are very, very lucky to be able to present these interviews over the next few weeks. Because I think there'll be three parts. It may only be two. I'm trying to keep the length down a little bit because the podcast has been running at least 30 minutes every episode lately. And we have our interview with Margaret that's coming up, but I don't want you to forget, don't leave after that's over, because we have our installment of This Week in Mayberry History with Randy Turner. So don't run away from me. Don't run away. Folks, we're going to get right into this interview so you guys can enjoy it. I know you're going to. So here is Margaret Carey. Now, for those of you that are audio listeners only, you will have a few places that I will have to describe to you, I believe, during the episode. So hopefully it won't take away from your enjoyment. If you're watching on the video, you're going to be able to see what she's doing. But I believe it's a great interview. I hope you're going to enjoy it. So here we are. This is on the cruise ship. So you're going to hear sounds and background sounds of the ship, the rumble, some of that kind of noise. And when we're starting here in just a second, she has already begun to talk about working on our gang just a little bit. She worked on the Little Rascals, our gang. That's what she's talking about, working as a child. So when she first begins talking here, that's what she's already talking about before I was able to start the recorder. So, okay. So let's head on over there. And you guys, I hope you're going to enjoy this. So here we go.
Put them to work. And I'm not complaining. They were wonderful. And so I could make $8.50 a day working. You saw me in the Our Gang picture of it. And I did that till 1936. So I have been working 84 years and happy to do it.
So there's your picture on the screen now. And so there you are. You're the one on the far left toward our side.
Far
here.
Right.
Far right. Yeah, right. Looking at my left.
You can't spell either.
I can't spell or see. So, and you had a different name then, right?
Yes. I started out with the name of Margaret Lorraine McCarty. I didn't remember it when I was adopted, so I became Peggy Robb. Then they put me in the movies, and the first thing I did was Midsummer Night's Dream. They changed it to Peggy Lynch. And then you saw me in a picture that I had with Eddie Cantor, and he changed my name to Margaret Carey. Then I married my darling husband, Dick Brown, Eric Norquist's father, and they changed it to Margaret Carey Brown. and I lost him, and then I became Margaret Carey Wilcox. No, I don't know who I am, except I have to watch up on the screen.
So you've had a long career. Do you have any real memories of working in our gang and Little Rascals?
Oh my, yes. I was in the Little Rascals. I was the blur. That's what I call myself, because they would hire you, and they wanted you to be 4 years old going on 32 and listen to absolutely everything that they said. I think I'm pretty much a disciplined person because of it. But anyway, that run over here and laugh, run over there and smile, run back there and cry. And so I would go by the camera all the time, and that was, so I called myself later on the blur. And it was a very different upbringing, and not unhappy upbringing. And people have said to me, did you enjoy your childhood? And I usually answer, as compared to what? You know, it was the one that I had. And so I got trained. You saw me dancing. I still tap dance on stage at 88, and that's one of the things that's kept me in trim. So it's been a wondrous time.
Yeah, so in the video you showed, who was it you were dancing with?
His name is Dick Humphreys. We went up and we played the Golden Gate Theater with Eddie Cantor. Yes, ma'am and sir. Here we are, and I hated it. I don't know how Vaudevillians ever did it. It was just... But Dick Humphreys was a great dancer. He went on to be the assistant to Gene Kelly. And then he turned around one day at 42 years of age and dropped dead.
Oh,
yeah, but he left a legacy like that. He was a dear man.
When I first started seeing you, you were dancing on those tables. First thing, of course, I'm thinking is those tables are going to fall over, is what I was thinking. Then I thought, well, they're hooked to the ground, but then they weren't. You actually rode the table down to the ground. So how did y'all keep from knocking them over?
I don't know. I don't know how they talked me into doing that. It was a strange time, because nowadays you're so used to going on the internet, and if you're working with somebody, you look up who they are and so. Well, Nick Castle designed that whole dance number to a song called My Brooklyn's Love Song. It was just adorable. We could watch the barges tow the garbage out to the sea, was one of the lines in it. And so he did all of that, and whatever Nick Castle said, well, it turned out to be that Nick Castle was one of the great choreographers. He was my teacher at the same time. But you never looked it up. You never knew who anybody really was, except when I got to the Andy Griffith Show. I have to tell this before I forget the man's name. There was a comedian on television named Bob Sweeney. You ever see the Box Brothers, I think, was Bob Sweeney and Mr. Peepers, whatever his name was. Anyway, I just thought he was the funniest man I ever saw.
Wally Cox.
Thank you, Wally Cox. Thank you, Patricia. So I walk on the set, and that's where they were casting, and I'm shown that I'm being put forward to be Bess Muggins on the show. And there is Andy Griffith saying, yes, I think you'll do just fine. And we'll have the script to you on Monday, and everything is fine. And, of course, that's what you always want to hear. But you know what I did? I turned my back on Andy Griffith, turned around to Bob Sweeney, and said, I think you're the funniest man on television. No, this is not the way to break into a new show, I will tell you.
That's great. Go ahead. That's awesome. So you were also in a show back in 1949 called The Ruggles. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yes. I had my own show, as a matter of fact, on Channel 13 called Teleteen Reporter while I was doing this show. And the reason I bring it up, guess what we did? We went to the high schools and found talented teenagers, and we put them on our show, and I was supposed to be the school reporter. That's the way and then I danced and sang on those shows. Does that give you a little thought of what's going on today with The View and all the rest of it? Well, at the same time, I got a call from my agent who said, they are casting for a network show at ABC. And I went over, and sure enough, I looked enough like the family, and Charlie Ruggles was the dad. It played for 5 years on the Almost Broadcasting Company. That's what we called ABC. And so I had a lovely time, but at the same time, I was doing my show. I was also doing radio. That's what you did then.
So Charles Ruggles, for Andy Griffith fans, he was on the color episode called Aunt Bee the Swinger. He played the retiring congressman. Yeah. So go ahead and hit it again. We got a little clip from this show we want to show you. So there's Margaret's name. I didn't recognize him until he started talking, honestly, as I was pulling this up.
What is the argument?
Santa won't let me read the letter to Santa Claus.
Oh? Well, now you you wrote that letter together, didn't you?
Yes, Daddy.
Well, then you can both read it together to me. So I'll tell you, Donna, you start, and Donald, you butt in anytime
okay.
you want.
Okay.
All right, sit
okay.
down there. Let's hear what you've written.
Great. I know someone.
Who?
Elaine Schumann.
Elaine Schumann?
You remember, she was in my graduating
class.
She has less than anybody I can think of. And she and her mother will probably be alone this year. Her father passed away, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but we hardly know her, sis. Why don't we just ask Marianne?
Oh, now, Chuck, dear, that isn't the idea at all. We want to get her.
So that's basically, I just want you to see Margaret back in those. And I was watching these clips coming up with things. I didn't realize it who he was until he started to talk. And as soon as he talked, I recognized him and started looking up, making sure that was who I thought. So how long did you do this show?
It played on the air for 5 years. The big difference was that that was a kinescope, and we would do the show twice, once for local and then once for back east, and then they would take a picture with a film camera of what was going out on TV, and we didn't have any tape or anything. Quick story. One of the terrible things that we had to do on the show, nobody had ever heard of a cue card when we did that show. You did it live. Anything that happened on that show went out over the air. And they decided that we should do commercials. And that's a terrible thing to do to an actor. We did 1 minute commercials before we went in, and they usually did it on the show that was all about you. So this has to do with Hal Smith, where I met Hal doing this show. Anyway, I'm standing up there, and I'm looking at the camera, and a lot of you don't know, a television camera is like a mirror. You're seeing yourself in a mirror. So I had all of this wonderful lines that we had to do about Dr. Ross dog food is doggone good, woof. That was the sponsor. So this was a time when you didn't believe anything a female told you. So the tail end of this commercial was, beautifully written by the advertising agency, went, "My father thinks Dr. Ross dog food is best for our dog. My brother thinks Dr. Ross dog food is best for our dog. And so do I." End of commercial. Well, I was looking and I'm thinking, oh, my hair is out of place. And I've got to get going. So I came to the very end and I said, "My dad likes Dr. Ross dog food. My brother likes Dr. Ross dog food, and so do I." They went out the next week and hired Hal Smith to do the announcing.
That's great. Go ahead. So then, also found this. You were on the Lone Ranger in 1950.
Yes. Yes.
So you want to? Do you have any memories about that?
Yes. My favorite memory. You don't mind if I stand up?
Oh, no,
I'm
no,
short.
No.
Did any of you notice I'm short? Okay. But one of my favorite, and I hope you enjoy this story, because I got a call from the same agent who had me come over for the Ruggles show and for the Andy Griffith show. And so I'm going to do a Western. Oh, boy, they were big time. And I'm going to be the Lone Ranger. And they sent me over to Western Costume Company. Now, that's 6 floors of the most incredible costume that you can imagine. Everybody goes there to get their costume. And I'm going over there, and everything is fine. I think I'm about 18 years of age, something like that. And, you know, everything is slim and trim, and et cetera. And so I needed a divided skirt because I was going to dismount from a horse. And so I thought, oh, great. We tried them on, and nothing looked good. And out they brought this absolutely fabulous, beautiful skin, cow skin divided skirt. It was, you know, and I put it on, and it was too big for me. Now, a 17-year-old in Hollywood, if an outfit was too big for you, you have come. However, the best part it was inside, it had been made for Ann Baxter. I was slimmer than Ann Baxter. I could be very shallow. You know, and so, oh, everything was fine, except I got it on a Friday afternoon, and there was no one to take it in. So I reported to duty, I think it was the next Monday, it might have been Tuesday, and they sewed me into it. So I thought, oh, this is keen, except I was sewed into it for 7 hours. It was a very interesting day. Clayton Bohr kept me very busy chit-chatting, along with Jay Silverheels. What wonderful gentlemen. I will just tell you another thing about, I will tell you about. If you watch The Lone Ranger, there's a big problem with The Lone Ranger, because when you had a close-up of Clayton Moore and he put the mask on and you put the lights on him, his beautiful, gorgeous blue eyes would go in the shadow. So what they did was they put a little inky dink, a little tiny Fresnel lens light down here, like this, and they put what they call a barn door to make a blue, a line across, put a blue gel across, and they it came right across where the mask was. Now, next time you watch a Lone Ranger and he does a close-up, you will notice he never moves his head. It's just absolutely fascinating what the difference that they made, all the tricks of the business. And I got to say, yes, Dad, he's the Lone Ranger.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So I really enjoyed it. I was enjoying going through and finding different things in her career. Of course, Peter Pan is a huge one, because that has been, I assume Peter Pan has probably impacted your life more than any other activity. So tell us some of the stuff about your
Okay. People usually like to know why I was cast in the part of Tinkerbell. I mean, she was very different. There were many, many people in the studio that didn't think that Tinkerbell was the right character. Remember, this was back in a time when they had all of the females were very demure, were acted upon, and all the show was around them, but she was actually acting out. So they really weren't quite sure, and I wasn't quite sure. I was working at Fox at the time as assistant dance director, and they call me, and over I go, and they want a pantomimist. And there weren't too many around, so they wanted me to do a scene. And the scene was, and you saw a little bit about it, of landing on the mirror on the dresser top. And I'm going to do it for you. I'll show you how I did it.
So she began to walk around on the stage doing the motions just like Tinkerbell did, where she stepped up onto the mirror, looked down and saw herself in the mirror and kind of checking herself out, looking at the back, looking around at her back, turning sideways and looking. And then she looks at her wings But then she realizes my hips are wide. She puts her hands out and realizes how big they are and then walks off the stage mad.
And they said, would it be convenient for you to come to work next Tuesday? So you saw I was in a one-piece bathing suit. They did up my hair. And I would go and do the scenes. And then they would call me because I was doing all this other stuff. They would call me back when it was convenient for me again. The other thing that I would like to point out was that they had a two-dimension character. Mark Davis, who designed Pirates of the Caribbean and the Haunted Mansion, and he designed Tinkerbell, Cruella de Vil also. But, and I said to him as I stepped out in front of the camera, I said, Mr. Davis, that's how long ago you call people Mr. And remember, no, you don't. You're too young. Anyway, I said, what do you want her to be like? Do you want her to be ditzy like Betty Boo? Do you want her to be above it all like Queen of the Fairies? He said, Margaret, we want her to be you. And I said, gosh golly, I think I can do that. And at that moment, I gave her the third dimension of her personality. 30 years later, I'm having lunch with Mark Davis and at Club 33, ladies and gentlemen. And he leaned over after I'd done something and he said, Margaret, you are still Tinkerbell. And I said, Mark, I think that's the nicest thing that you have ever said to me. Except maybe, would it be convenient to come to work next Tuesday? I also said, Mark, do you know, she's the icon. You know that she is recognized in Outer Mongolia? I mean, you are looking at an icon, folks. Anyway, I said to him, you drew her showing her underpants. Did you ever think about that? There's no... And he said, yes, Margaret. And did you notice they're always clean?
Go ahead to the next. We have a lot. I found a lot of things. But we've always heard about you being Tinkerbell. But that wasn't the only thing you did. The Tinkerbell was the big thing. And we've definitely have heard you talk about that. You've got the book about it. You've got... all kinds of interviews that you've done over the years. And you mentioned this some, but you were also, there's a picture of her there on the screen, the one on the top playing the harp type thing. I think it's a harp.
A lyre.
Okay. She was the little red-haired mermaid, too. So this is the shot there. So did you do any other things like that?
Well, it was the big change in my life doing that. I decided at that time, and the Andy Griffith Show was a change in my life also. The reason I say that was I could see the writing on the wall of the way that the industry was going. And I think that we have seen all the headlines lately about a certain fella and what has been going on behind the scenes. And I didn't want any part of that. I've been a Christian since 1949. God has put up with me for a long time, and I just didn't want to get into that. So what did you do? I had a line that changed my life. And when you see the movie, the red-headed mermaid says, we just wanted to drown her. And I thought, voiceover. And so that's what I did from then on, over 600 cartoons with the Three Stooges, with Clutch Cargo, with all kinds of people doing different voices, and the reason I bring it up, with Hal Smith. Most of the time we were talking on the microphone across from each other, doing all kinds of different voices and dialects, etc., etc. So that was the big change. When I worked with the Three Stooges, we did, I don't know how many, 139, whatever it was. That's where my son and I worked together for the first time. That's Eric right there, that big old guy. And he was a football player in one of the scenes, and we've been working together ever since.
So when you were doing the Peter Pan, I didn't realize that, I guess they had, I should have thought of this, but there was an actor that did Peter Pan too. So who were...
Well, Connie Hilton was the blonde, and the dark-haired. Have any of you ever seen or listened to Rocky and Bullwinkle or seen the cartoon?
Yes.
Well, June Foray is the voice of Rocky. And that's June is the dark-haired. We just lost her. She missed being 100 years old by 1 month. She stopped working about 4 years ago doing voices. And so all of us, the three of us, stood there outside the Disney gates and said, this is the way to go. No makeup if you don't want, no hairdo fix, no costume. You don't have to learn a script. You walk in at 1 o'clock because your voice is strong there, you record and you leave. And so we all went into voiceover work from there. June was a very, very favorite of mine. She was even shorter than I am, if you can imagine. So we talked across on the microphones most of the time. We were recording back and forth.
Yeah, she did a lot of voiceover. She was, I think she was a lot of the Bugs Bunny characters. She was the Warner Brothers cartoon. She was the witch. I think she was that character. Anyway, she did a lot of things. So yeah, I've always thought that voiceover acting seemed like a lot of fun to do. I know Hal Smith, he was involved in that greatly too. So go ahead to the next shot here.
All right, folks, I hope you guys are enjoying that. That is part one of our interview with Margaret. We will have more coming up in the coming weeks. So I hope you guys are enjoying that. And now we're on to our segment that we have enjoyed for, well, going into our second year now. From Randy Turner for This Week in Library History.
Welcome to This Week in Mayberry History, a report by special correspondent Randy Turner of the Gomer and Cooper Pyle Comic Book Literary Guild of the Mayberry Historical Society.
One of the most disliked episodes of the Andy Griffith Show by fans was ironically the episode that saw the return of the beloved Barney Fife to Mayberry, and it first aired on January the 10th, 1966. The Andy Griffith Show often simply did not explain changes in Mayberry. When the first color episode aired in season 6 after Don Knotts had left the show to pursue a film career, no mention was made that Barney was no longer a deputy. In the 5th episode, when the new deputy Warren was introduced, Goober simply asked Andy, "Do you like that feller you got working for you?" And that was the extent of it. There was no animosity that Don had left the series, and he and Andy remained lifelong friends. So it is not surprising that the producers were happy to have Don return as a guest star 5 times in the color episodes. The return of Barney Fife was the first episode in which he did so. Barney was returning for a class reunion in a storyline that was a reworking of a storyline that had been used in the black and white years. There are even callbacks to that episode. When making name tags for the reunion with Helen, Aunt Bee read a letter from Sharon Despain, the old girlfriend of Andy's who was featured on the earlier class reunion episode. And of course, entertainment at the reunion was still provided by Carl Benson's Wildcats. Not only was no mention made earlier of what had become of Barney, but from when he first is seen pulling into town, it took nearly 3 minutes for any reference to even be made that he was still working in law enforcement. And just as no reference had been made in the earlier color episodes as to what had become of Barney, no reference or explanation had been made as to what had become of Thelma Lou. Like Barney, she had simply disappeared. When Thelma Lou appeared at the reunion, viewers learned she was a redhead, something that was obviously not apparent in the black and white episodes and that hadn't been referenced, unless one saw publicity photos from the show. After they danced, and right after Barney told Andy he could tell Thelma Lou was still crazy about him, she returned with a man she introduced as her new husband, Gerald Whitfield. The episode was written by Bill Idelson and Sam Bobrick. It was just one of 19 episodes they wrote for the show. In fact, their episode, The Shoplifters, was the third and final time an Andy Griffith Show episode won the Writers Guild of America Award. And blame really cannot be placed on them. Story ideas were all agreed to by the producers and then assigned to writers. But there can be no argument that the events in this episode were antithetical to everything the show espoused. Betty Lynn has said many times that she did not believe the storyline fit with everything that had been seen previously, and she played the part as though Thelma Lou might have brought a friend who was only pretending to be her husband. But of course, the show really did portray her as having married, though the situation was finally rectified in the reunion movie Return to Mayberry, when Barney and Thelma Lou were finally married. Don Knotts' performance, however, was as masterful as ever, and was later rewarded with his fourth Emmy Award. Don guest starred again in the next episode when Warren was in awe of The Legend of Barney Fife. Don appeared again the next season twice as well, first when Andy visited him in Raleigh, and in the following episode when Barney came back to Mayberry and ended up escorting Tina Andrews to her film premiere, a performance that earned him an unprecedented fifth Emmy for playing the same character in the same series. And he returned for a single episode in the last season to arrange a summit meeting that ended up being held in the Taylor home. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening, and remember to take Andy's advice and go out there and act like somebody.
Thank you, Randy. Thank you so much. Wow, what a great report. That episode has always been a hard one for me, but hey, if you're enjoying This Week in Mayberry History, Randy also publishes a weekly version of This Week in Mayberry History over in the Gomer and Goober Pyle Comic Book Literary Guild. And since it's weekly, it's hard to catch. You may miss it, so send Randy an email at turnersgrade@gmail.com. It's Turners, T-U-R-N-E-R-S, turnersgrade@gmail.com, and he will make sure you don't miss a post when he does them. So yeah, that was always a hard episode for me. I've always hated it when Thelma Lou came back, and I actually talked to Betty herself, as he mentioned, and she said that the only way she could play the role was to pretend that Thelma Lou was just pretending to be married, that she didn't want to come back and not be married, and Barney had gone off and been successful, and you know, so she just got a friend to pretend like he was married to her, and that's how she did the role. So she was playing Thelma Lou doing that at that event. So anyway, I watched that today, and I actually did enjoy it. There were several references and stuff in that episode that are fun if you can just get past the Thelma Lou breaking Barney's heart. Oh, it hurts. Folks, hey, I hope you have enjoyed the Margaret Carey interview, part one. I hope you enjoyed Randy's segment. I know you did. You always do. And I'm looking forward to next week. I'd love to hear from you. You can give me a call at 888-684-8415. Drop by over at twochairsnowaiting.com and click the contact button. All kinds of ways to contact me there, but I'd like to hear from you. I'm still wanting to hear from you guys about some of the stuff you might have gotten at Christmas that was Mayberry related. Not necessarily t-shirts or stuff you bought from Weavers, but maybe this individual little items like this one I got that's Hallmark. It was a Tinkerbell Hallmark ornament that was actually signed by Margaret Carey. My wife gave that to me. Plus, the jacket that's behind me, I'll show this to you. As soon as I get more people telling me things they got, some cool Mayberry gifts. Folks, I'd love to hear from you. I hope you had a great week, and we'll see you next time right here on Two Chairs.